Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire someone with a disability. More information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of abilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, because people want to work. And the Fresh from Florida program, supporting Florida's economy by promoting agricultural products grown right here at home, including a variety of seafood harvested by commercial fishermen along Florida's Gulf Coast. On the web at freshfromflorida.com. WFSU-FM Tallahassee and other Florida public radio stations. From the state capitol, the Florida Public Radio Network brings you Capitol Report.
Some say the governor's billion-dollar increase for education shows he's learning more about what Floridians really want.
He learned a lot from last year and this year.
But education advocates say the governor's words and his actions on education don't match up.
And it just means not only will these smaller districts not pay for those services, they'll just go without them. And it's going to create a big divide. It's, in my mind, class warfare.
The new budget means layoffs for two North Florida hospitals. In a surprising move, accused murderer George Zimmerman apologizes to the family of Trayvon Martin. And 2 years following the Gulf oil spill, the debate on Drill Baby Drill rages on. I'm Tramell Gomes, and that's all coming up on Capitol Report. Governor Rick Scott used the backdrop of a St. Johns County elementary school to sign the 2012-2013 state budget. As Kevin Mearshart from member station WJCT in Jacksonville reports, Scott vetoed far fewer projects than he did last year.
Governor Rick Scott signed the state's $70 billion budget at a high-performing elementary school to highlight a $1 billion increase in education spending. Scott says the budget will improve education and job growth in the state.
If you think about what Floridians care about, they care about making sure their children can get an education, make sure they can get a job, and make sure we don't do things that raise the cost of living. So I'm very honored to be governor and sign this budget, and I look forward to having a great year next year and getting more people back to work.
Scott announced over $142 million in line item vetoes, far less than the $615 million he cut last year. Several projects that remained in the budget were cut last year. The governor says his staff met with lawmakers and project advocates to ensure dollars are being well spent.
I think we reviewed 440 projects, and sort of the filter was this. I think about, and I think all of us think about, the family that's making $40,000 a year. They're paying sales taxes, they're paying property taxes, they pay fees to the state. We've got to make sure their dollars are spent well. So we looked at it and said, is this a good use of their money? So is it a statewide project or is it a local project? Is it something that's going to help all the citizens? Is it something that we can feel comfortable that we're getting a return on our investment?
One item vetoed last year that is in this year's budget is funding for public television. Governor Scott said advocates were able to make their case for the educational benefits of the service.
They came back and they showed us that there's a good return on those dollars. I looked at projects and said, look, I treated some projects just like we treat economic development. If we don't get the return they say they were going to get, they'll give us the money back. And so this is the families of Florida's money. All of us up here, we're doing our best to try to make sure that we get a return for those families.
Last year, when the governor vetoed over $600 million from the budget, he was criticized by lawmakers from both parties for not listening to them as to why those budgeted items were important. Scott said this year was different as he was able to spend more time talking to advocates.
I know more people. When I ran, I was the outsider, so I've gotten a lot more feedback. On top of that, you know, I think what's happened is, just like the public television, they've come back and explained their returns. Now, you know, everybody is not going to, you know, we're all not exactly the same, so we're all not going to want to do all the same projects. But, you know, I used my best efforts to say what's in the best interest for all the taxpayers of the state, and you know, it's not an easy task.
Among the lawmakers on hand for the budget signing was State Senator John Thrasher. Last year, Scott vetoed $10 million to clean up the St. Johns River. It was a bill championed by Thrasher, and he made it a high priority to get funding back in this year's budget. This year's funding of $5.6 million was approved by the governor. Thrasher says this year there was better communication between supporters of the river cleanup efforts and the administration.
He learned a lot from last year and this year. I was pretty adamant about that, I think. And so was Secretary Vineyard, by the way, who is a great friend of mine and doing a great job for the governor. So we'll get $5.6 million into the budget, into the water management district, to work on nutrient problems in the St. Johns River, and I think it's a great win for everybody.
Thrasher and other lawmakers who attended the budget signing says getting the balanced budget wasn't easy. The state faced a shortfall of about $1 billion next year, on top of the nearly $4 billion gap during the current year. They said the governor deserves credit for working with the legislature to reach a budget deal. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kevin Mershart in Jacksonville.
Included in the state's new budget is extra money for education. That marks a shift for Governor Rick Scott after last year's $1.3 billion budget cut. Scott made education funding his legislative priority, but as Lynn Hatter reports, public school advocates and officials say the boost doesn't go far enough.
Governor Scott says he learned a lot in his first 2 years in office, and the extra funding is an example of that. Organizations like the Pro Charter School Group, the Foundation for Florida's Future, applauded the move. Spokeswoman Jaron Emhoff says it's not enough that lawmakers put in the extra money, but that they took a targeted approach in where to put it.
Some of those funds are going to the school recognition program, which rewards schools and teachers and leaders whose students are making progress and making gains, and it's important to reward and incentivize student learning. It also provides more funding to reading, and reading is such a critical skill, and it's important that students gain that early because it will impact the rest of their education career.
State lawmakers funded an extra hour of reading in the state's lowest performing schools, and they also put money into teacher bonuses, which were cut last year. People like Colleen Wood, who heads a group backing traditional public schools, says there's a lot more the state has to do when it comes to supporting public education.
Well, I believe that the budget this year is a step in the right direction, but it is just that. It is a step. It's a partial restoration of the $1.3 billion that was cut last year and the 5 years of steady cuts we've seen previous to that.
Other groups like the state's teachers unions just aren't that impressed. Florida Education Association President Andy Ford says this year's billion-dollar increase still falls short of the $1.35 billion cut from education last year.
Well, the state had many, many options that they could have done. The budget right now still is a $345 per student cut from last year. It was a missed opportunity. Once again, there were tax cuts for corporations, and that outweighed the needs of Florida's children.
The governor says last year's cut was incurred as the last of the federal stimulus money dried up, and this year's education increase will mostly fill budget holes created by an increase in the number of students and falling property tax collections. In all, the increase amounts to an extra $150 a student, which brings per-student funding up to about $6,350 per child. That's still about $800 less than the state's peak education funding year, which was 2008. Governor Rick Scott also vetoed $142 million worth of projects, some within the education budget. A panhandle consortium of small school districts is reeling from a $1 million veto. Wakulla School Superintendent David Miller called the move short-sighted.
It was done without a lot of thought into what happens with these dollars and how they support these small rural districts, and it just means not only will these small rural districts not pay for those services, they'll just go without them, and it's going to create a big divide. It's, in my mind, class warfare.
The Panhandle Area Education Consortium provides services to smaller school districts that can't afford to do them on their own, things like coming up with new teacher evaluation systems or holding training workshops to prepare teachers for the state's new standardized tests, which are coming in the next few years. Miller says such cuts to programs like the consortium places smaller school districts at a competitive disadvantage to larger, more affluent districts. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, the governor's approval of the state budget is bad news for two North Florida hospitals facing hundreds of layoffs.
We're laying out some of the lowest paid people in the state of Florida, and we don't have any compassion for some of them who worked 30 years.
And in a surprising move today, accused murderer George Zimmerman apologizes to Trayvon Martin's family.
I am sorry for the loss of your son.
A labor union and several lawmakers are working together to delay a budgetary move by the Department of Children and Families. As Sasha Cordner reports, the agency is trying to privatize custodial and maintenance services at a couple of hospitals that could cost hundreds of state employees their jobs.
Governor Rick Scott recently signed a budget that allows the Department of Children and Families to outsource the housekeeping and maintenance services at two North Florida hospitals. By doing so, the department is expected to save $1.7 million. However, it also means the hospitals will lay off 260 employees, 226 workers at Florida State Hospital in Chattahoochee, and 34 at Northeast Florida State Hospital in McClenny.
Now, you're talking about one of the poorest counties in the state of Florida. And I'm just really concerned. These people are not getting a fair shake.
Jeanette Nguyen is the president of Florida's chapter of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, or AFSCME. She says Florida State Hospital is the biggest employer in Chattahoochee, which already suffered from 300 layoffs last year. Nguyen says these are Florida residents who've made their home in Gadsden County, and it's just not fair.
We're laying off some of the lowest paid people in the state of Florida. And we don't have any compassion for some of them who worked 30 years, who've been excellent employees, looking at some of their evaluations. Some of them beyond 50 years old, beyond middle age. And now you're telling them to go back out in the workforce and find a job?
Nguyen's union has been trying to come up with ways to save the employees' jobs. Two meetings were recently scheduled between DCF and AFSCME, but the department canceled after the union sent a letter to the department asking for an analysis proving privatization was the only way to save money. The union also reminded the department that it could not yet sign a contract with Aramark. That's the vendor slated to take over the hospital's custodial services. The date of that deal depends on a bill the governor has yet to approve. Republican Representative Marty Coley of Marianna and Democratic Senator Bill Monford of Tallahassee have also been working towards slowing the privatization process. Monford says he recently met with DCF's deputy secretary and expressed his concerns about how the state has already started to drop a contract with the private vendor Aramark without the department exhausting all its options.
So my question was, why would we be moving forward in the privatization process? In other words, the company meeting with the employees, telling them how they can apply for a job with them, and when the pink slip would go out, and when their contract would be up with the state. Why would we do that when we don't even know whether or not we, meaning the state, can realize the savings? And to make that decision, you got to have the good, sound, complete data.
But DCF spokesman Joe Follick says lawmakers and the unions need to realize that this is not a snap decision. He says this transition has been a year in the making, and even if they wait a couple more months, opponents are just delaying the inevitable.
Just like any family, when you have decisions to make, if you can do something with the same outcome for lower cost, you're going to make that decision. You know, this is not a sudden decision. We have analyzed it. We are not doing it on a whim. This is a business decision that is going to let us maintain our attention on frontline services and, you know, the maintenance and the upkeep that is currently being performed by state employees will be performed by other employees, by another company.
At the same time, Follick says DCF cares about the employees affected by the decision, and his department is doing the best it can to help them. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
The man who shot 17-year-old Trayvon Martin will be released from jail. A Seminole County judge granted George Zimmerman bail in the amount of $150,000 today after the Sanford man spent more than a week behind bars. From member station WMFE in Orlando, Nicole Creston reports the bond hearing brought new information and another strange twist to the case.
In a surprising move, 28-year-old George Zimmerman took the stand to apologize to the parents of Trayvon Martin, who were sitting in the courtroom.
I am sorry for the loss of your son. I did not know how old he was. I thought he was a little bit younger than I am, and I did not know if he was armed or not.
Martin's mother, Sabrina Fulton, did not look at Zimmerman while he spoke. State Prosecutor Bernie De La Rianda did not seem impressed with the apology.
Why did you wait so long to tell Mr. Martin and the victim's mother, the father and mother, why did you wait so long to tell them?
I was told not to communicate with them.
The two-hour bond hearing Friday morning also yielded new information about the case against Zimmerman, who claims he was defending himself when he shot the unarmed teen in late February. Zimmerman was arrested on second-degree murder charges on April 11th. Dale Gilbreth, investigator for the state attorney's office, told Zimmerman attorney Mark O'Mara that Zimmerman's account of the shooting did not add up.
He mentioned that his head was being physically bashed against the concrete sidewalk, and that this was just prior to him firing the shot, and that he managed to scoot away from the concrete sidewalk, and that is at that point is when the shooting subsequently followed. That is not consistent with the evidence we found.
Gilbreth did say the wounds on the back of Zimmerman's head were consistent with a hit against concrete or at least something very heavy. Zimmerman's mother, father, and wife also testified by phone, each promising to help him comply with conditions of bail. And there are conditions, said Judge Kenneth Lester.
There is to be no possession of firearms, be they rifles, shotguns, handguns, pistols, revolvers, any type of firearm or destructive device. There's to be no consumption of alcohol. There's to be a curfew from 7 o'clock p.m. till 6 o'clock a.m.
Also, Zimmerman may not have contact with Trayvon Martin's family and must wear a GPS tracking device. Fitting for that device and security issues delayed Zimmerman's release until after Friday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nicole Creston in Orlando.
You're listening to Capitol Report on the Florida Public Radio Network. I'm Tramell Gomes. The Florida Supreme Court is hearing oral arguments on the Senate's new voting district maps. The court ruled the first maps were constitutionally invalid. Now Regan McCarthy reports the justices today reviewed the Senate's second try.
The attorney representing the Senate in the case, former Florida Supreme Court Justice Raul Quintero, says the Senate addressed everything the justices asked to be done after their last review.
The court first asked us to, or ordered us to, redraw the eight districts that Justice Pariente had identified to conduct a functional analysis as to certain districts that we felt that we had said we needed to maintain in a certain configuration, to preserve the city of Lakeland, if possible, and to adopt an incumbent neutral numbering scheme. As to most of those, there is now no dispute.
But Paul Smith, who represents the Florida chapter of the League of Women Voters, said the Senate maps, quote, didn't do nearly enough to limit the glaring favoritism for political parties and incumbents. Smith argues the Supreme Court should review the entire map instead of just checking to make sure the changes it requested have been made.
The court did not simply invalidate eight districts. The court gave additional instructions to the Senate that require a much broader review. It said, for example, that the Senate's understanding of the requirement of respect for political and geographic boundaries was completely off base, that they had to go back and start over on that.
Smith goes on to say that the court shouldn't just take the Senate's word that it operated in a blind and neutral manner. And John Mills, who's representing the Florida Democratic Party in the case, echoes Smith's feeling that the Supreme Court is charged with taking a second look at the entire map.
This court made an enormous effort to draft a thorough and comprehensive district to set out standards for a very important 10-year future of Florida. And it's very important that the court have the opportunity to finish the business by reviewing the validity of every district.
In its initial review, the court voted 5-2 that the Senate maps violated the state constitution. Supreme Court Justice Barbara Pariente authored the court's majority opinion. She says she's not sure the ruling requires a second look at the complete map.
Reading the entire opinion, it would seem that, speaking for person that wrote it, that it was pretty clear that there were certain districts that were specifically invalidated. There were other districts that were where challenges were specifically rejected.
Pariente says it wouldn't be fair to the Senate to raise questions about the constitutionality of districts the court previously okayed. Justice Peggy Quince agrees, saying the court has already looked at the whole map. Pariente did raise some questions about the lottery numbering system the Senate used to assign district numbers, which could affect how long some lawmakers can stay in office before being term limited out. But Quintero, the Senate's lawyer, says there are no challenges against it and adds that because it's random, it couldn't intentionally give any party a preference.
There were 29 incumbents that would be subject to that. Of the 16 that had numbers that restrict their eligibility, 13 of them were Republican.
The Supreme Court is charged with reviewing whether the maps meet the state's constitutional requirements. If they decide they don't, the court will be charged with redrawing the maps this time around. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Internet cafes with electronic sweepstakes machines and how to regulate them was a hotly debated issue in the Florida legislature this year. But both an outright ban and regulations of the machines failed to pass. Jessica Palumbo of member station WJCT in Jacksonville reports that in absence of a state law, a recent judge's ruling gives cities and counties the unchecked power to regulate electronic sweepstakes machines.
Internet cafes have sprung up all over Florida over the past 5 years. More than 1,000 of them do business, and they employ as many as 13,000 workers, according to one Florida State University study. Often found in strip malls, the cafes sell internet access on computers. And as a means of promoting that service, they often install software that offers patrons a chance to win money when they buy access. And while people wait to see if they won the prize money, they see images on the screen.
Some of those images simulate or look like images that you might see on a slot machine. But that is just the visual entertainment.
That's Kelly Mathis, a Jacksonville lawyer who has represented some internet cafe operators. Mathis says internet cafes comply with state sweepstakes laws that have been on the books since the early 70s. The difference between the electronic sweepstakes machines and a traditional slot machine lies in what you're paying for.
For instance, if you walk up to a slot machine, you pay a dollar and you either win or you don't. With a sweepstakes, you buy a product or service, and regardless of whether you win anything in the sweepstakes, you still get the product or service.
The service being internet access in this case. The same principle applies to the McDonald's Monopoly game or a store that offers a sweepstakes entry for completing a survey. But opponents of electronic sweepstakes machines, who include Florida Governor Rick Scott, have said they equate the practice with gambling. This year, a Florida Senate bill aimed to regulate it, while a House bill would have banned it altogether. Both efforts died. But back in 2010, the city of Jacksonville became the first in the state to impose a rigorous permitting process to operate the machines. Cherry Shaw, Jacksonville's assistant general counsel, says the city wants to protect people from its roughly 50 internet cafes.
These particular activities are used primarily by individuals with, I guess, low income, and they pretty much use all of their money in these machines, and so the city felt compelled to enact this in the interest of the public health, peace, safety, morals, and the general welfare of the citizens of Duval County.
Among other restrictions, the Jacksonville ordinance requires internet cafes to undergo regular inspections. Alcohol sales are prohibited when 10 or more machines are present. No minors are allowed on premises. The ordinance went unchallenged until recently, when a Jacksonville cafe was issued a citation and then challenged it in court as unconstitutional. Last week, Judge John Moran upheld the Jacksonville ordinance, saying it does not conflict with Florida law, which is mostly silent on the issue. Lawyer Kelly Mathis says the decision sets an important precedent that could ripple throughout the state.
I think that it may give some comfort to other cities and counties throughout the state that they can also impose very strict requirements on these businesses.
And they have. Using Jacksonville's regulation as a model, several counties and cities, including Leon and St. John's counties and the city of Palm Beach, have passed or are considering their own regulations on internet cafes. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Finally, today's the second anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. That also falls 2 days before Earth Day. Those events come at the same time the debate over the future of oil is ramping up. Tom Flanagan talked with people on both sides of the issue and filed this report.
Much has been made of both events with special observances and news stories. But for the average person, there's a more immediate and persistent reality when it comes to the fossil fuel known as gasoline. That is the fact the cost of a gallon of regular is still flirting with the $4 mark. The recent run-up in pump prices has taken place despite a dip in domestic demand and an increase in domestic production. Jack Girard is president and CEO of the American Petroleum Institute in Washington, D.C. He says at least part of the increase is driven by speculation, but he insists more domestic production would put downward pressure on worldwide oil prices.
As the Congressional Research Service points out, we are the most energy-rich nation in the world. We have vast quantities of oil and natural gas right here. So while we can't totally control the Middle East, while we can't totally impact what's going on the global basis, we can contribute by bringing more supply to the marketplace.
Aliki Moncrief, who heads Environment Florida, doesn't think that would have much impact.
Our total reserves are 2% of what exists in the world, but our consumption is 20% of world production. And so the idea that extracting every last drop that we have in the U.S., the idea that that 2% is going to drive down the world market is completely false.
Gerard counters that more domestic natural gas production has caused a plunge in prices, the same he says will work when it comes to oil.
And if we were to take that experience, expand it to crude oil as well, we'd see the same thing longer term. That's why we're very bullish and upbeat about not only the benefits to create jobs in this country to produce oil and gas, but the huge benefit to consumers.
A view not shared by Brad Ashwell of the Florida Public Interest Research Group.
The bottom line of the solution is that we can somehow drill our way out of our problems, and that's just not the case. I mean, most people would agree with the president, most experts agree with the president, in fact, that oil speculation is playing a large role in driving up oil and gas prices. Whether Congress will do something about that or something can be done about that on the global scale is a question.
Another issue is closer to home as far as Floridians are concerned. It's the lingering damage, both ecological and financial, from the BP oil spill catastrophe 2 years ago. The Petroleum Institute's Gerard acknowledges it was something that should never have happened. He also says the industry is determined it won't happen again.
We've developed what we call the Center for Offshore Safety based in Houston. Through that, we're bringing in third-party auditors, people unaffiliated with the oil and gas industry, to audit our operations, to look at them with an independent view, to make sure that we're bringing best practices. And not only are we protecting our people, but we're protecting the environment.
Environment Florida's Moncrief believes no oversight body, no matter how well-intentioned, can change the risk equation.
The oil industry, they're pushing further and further out. They're going deeper and deeper and deeper, and the technology isn't there. There is no guarantee of safe oil drilling. And for Florida, the risk so outweighs the benefit. I mean, all of the risk is borne by the public.
BP continues to pay compensation for the spill. On top of the billions already paid, more cash is on the way to those damaged by the disaster. An independent audit of the Gulf Claims Facility, urged by U.S. Senator Bill Nelson and others in Congress, forced the reevaluation of more than 7,000 claims valued at some $64 million. More than half of the claims are in Florida, and that's where about $38 million of the money will go. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Tom Blanigan.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are James Call, Sasha Cordner, Tom Flanagan, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to the contributing stations along the Florida Public Radio Network. Taylor Cox provides technical assistance for Capitol Report, and I'm Trimmel Gomes, inviting you to join us next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, because people want to work. And the Fresh from Florida program, supporting Florida's economy by promoting agricultural products grown right here at home, including a variety of seafood harvested by commercial fishermen along Florida's Gulf Coast. On the web at freshfromflorida.com. WFSU-FM Tallahassee and other Florida public radio stations. This is the Florida Public Radio Network.